once again. Thank you. Would you check it again to make sure? Lecture. What?
First tape
it
tonight.
Yeah, tape the first part tonight. This is the second part. Lecture second nine. Part. So, what we're doing then, as we look at covenant all the way through, is we're beginning to recognize His faithfulness to relationship, and then we come with a reasonable response to such a faithful relationship, right? That's why we need to understand the entire covenant story, the entire story of God, rather than, see what happens when we look at the Bible as a self-help book? There's no story, right? If it's a self-help book, it's just, let me turn to page, 92 to figure out what's going on with, how do I handle people I don't like?
And you really just want to make your circumstances better.
Exactly. Right. So when you're looking at it, the Bible as a self-help book, it's a transactional book, right? But it's His story. And I don't know how many of you, when you read novels, read the end of the story first. But I can't ever do that. I want to be able to read the entire story first. Mm-hmm. Because what I've told you is if it's a good novel, if it's a good story, the beginning always tells you the end anyway. Mm-hmm. If you're attentive to that, you'll begin to see, oh, I know what's going to happen. How is that going to happen now? And going all the way through. So we need to understand God's story. And God's story is told through covenant relationship with Israel. So we'll always begin to look at that so we understand His faithfulness. So as we begin the covenant phases, we begin with what I'll call the plan, right? So God already started with Adam with a plan, and now He has to renew that plan when Adam falls, right? When Adam and Eve decide to not go with that plan. So what we see, and this is really review, but I want us to put it kind of in a concise way. And at the end, I'll just put it in a big chart and you'll be able to see that. God gives gracious attention in order to reveal His desire. So we see that in the Adamic and the Noahic phase. So those two together are one phase, right? And we see Him giving gracious attention both to Adam, right? He doesn't, when Adam and Eve decide to go independent, He doesn't say, oh, well, and walk away, right? He actually gives them great attention. And He gives that to all the people that
she wants to braid.
Yes, begin to braid. That begin to come after Noah, right? We see that He's giving attention. We see that He knows what they're doing when they're building the Tower of Babel, that they're trying to get Him to come down, that they're trying to be in charge and say, all right, God, it's time for you to come down. But what we see in both of those covenant phases, in that one covenant phase, is that He's giving His full attention to creating a space for secure attachment. That's exactly what He started in creation, right? He was, all of Genesis 1 and 2 talks about God ordering life on earth so that there's a place for secure attachment. And that we talk about, I mean, you'll see it in the news all the time. The theory of secure attachment, right? Or attachment theory, sometimes it's called. And they're discovering that that's the basis of knowing you belong, is a secure attachment through attention. That's what God has been doing throughout. And that's what He's doing with the Noahic and Adamic covenants. And so He introduces His faithfulness in relationship within that first phase of the Adamic and the Noahic covenant. That's good. He does it, first of all, by keeping, part of His way of showing that He has faithfulness in relationship is actually closing off the tree of life, right? That's a good thing, right? That wasn't a bad thing. That was a good thing. Because they, if they had access to the tree of life, they would live eternally without relationship with Him, without right relationship with Him, and without right relationship with Him, they would not have right relationship with one another. And so that the fact that He closes off access to the tree of life says to Adam, says to the rest of humanity as it comes, I'm concerned about relationship. I'm not concerned about your happiness. I'm concerned about your relationship. Because in relationship, will you be fully human? Nothing else. So this is an indication that he's showing that he's graciously paying attention to the fact that what they need is relationship, and they need right relationship. When we get to the Noah story, we also understand that he's giving a promise to all creation that he's not going to use force to bring this relationship about, right? And how do we know that?
He hangs up his weapons,
right? That's what when we see the rainbow. You know, we have made the rainbow into this kind of little girl princessy thing, right? Into, oh, it's nice and it's sweet and God's wonderful and beautiful. But what God, that's God's weapon up there. And he's saying, I'm not going to force you into relationship because a forced relationship isn't a right relationship, right? So I'm going to bring about an open invitation to relationship in a different way. It's not going to be by force. It's not going to be by strength as we know it. So we see this as an indication that he's faithful to relationship, that that's what he is all about. Relationship is his central concern. They show grace, in other words, because humanity didn't deserve it, right? It didn't. Adam and Eve didn't deserve attention. Nor did all of Noah's relatives and all the people that populate the earth through to Babel. They didn't deserve it, so it's grace. His attention is grace. How many times have you had someone completely ignore you? What is your, almost always, your instinct to do if someone's ignoring you?
Okay. Ignore them,
right? I think that's the more common. To just, fine, if they don't want to pay attention to me, fine. I'll just ignore them. And yet God does it the opposite, right? He says, I'm going to pay attention to you. So what? You're not paying attention to me? It does not mean that I'm going to turn around and walk away and look for somebody else. I'm going to pay attention to you. So that it is in our rebellion that God uses covenant to affirm his gracious attention. It's in our rebellion, right? That tells us that God desires relationship with us, that he continues to pay attention to us through covenant relationship. All of that so that I can respond by beginning to pay attention to his faithfulness, right? Have you ever had an experience where you've been the one to ignore someone and they continue to pay attention to you, mm-hmm. pay attention to you, pay attention to you? I mean, at some point, you're just like, why are you paying attention to me? Why do you care so much about me that even when I'm ignoring you, when I'm pushing you away, you're still desiring relationship? I mean, that's always an awesome thing, right? When Christian was little, there was a little boy in church that just kept saying, I want to be your friend. And he was a real extrovert, and Christian was, you know, an introvert. And he's just like, oh, too much. And he would never, you know, he would call him all the time, can you come over and play? And he wouldn't, you know. Every once in a while, we'd make them get together. This kid kept doing it and kept doing it and kept doing it. Every single year, this kid was just following him. And sometimes Christian would do it. Eventually, of course, Christian was like, why do you care so much about me? Mm-hmm. And they began to, of course, be friends, and then be better friends, and then be better friends, so that when they went to college, well, first when they went to high school, they formed a band together. When they went to college, they roommated together for all 4 years. And then Alex got married first, and Christian was his best man. So all this time, Alex pursued Christian, to the point where Christian was like, I can't ignore you, right? Mm-hmm. And they became best friends and are still best friends, even though they are so wildly different. Mm-hmm. They remain friends because of this pursuit, right? This huge pursuit. The psalmist says to God, why do you care about man? He's nothing. Why do you care? Why do you pay so much attention to him? And of course God says, because I want relationship with you. Which is this little Alex, when Alex was little, he, like, I have never seen a kid who just wanted relationships so badly that he just broke Christian down all the walls. And it was really interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. So that's the Noahic and Adamic.
I wonder, question, like, what and who do you pursue? Like, who do we pursue?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
God pursues us like that. Do we share that with others?
Right, right, exactly.
You know what, though? I remember before I was a Christian, there was a girl I worked with, and I knew she had something I wanted. Mm. And I pursued her.
Really? That's interesting.
I knew there was something different about her.
Wow.
What was it?
Christ.
Yeah.
And, you know, we worked together a lot where we could talk. We were in a room alone, actually with another girl who was deaf. But she shared the gospel with me.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's really cool. And that tells you right there that why God needs to, first of all, bring judgment when we're not presenting him correctly, right? Because when we do, we are compelling to others. Like this girl, right? Like, she presented who Christ was really, and that was compelling. All that rolls into everything we understand and learn about what Christ has done through covenant.
You know, it also is a good way to know how to talk about Christ, because she didn't throw up on me.
Right.
She just lived this life,
yes,
that drew me.
Yes.
And I just wanted to know what made her different.
Right, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So when we get to the second phase of covenant, we call that the promise, right? So we have the plan. The plan is, I'm going to reveal that I have a desire for relationship, and I'm going to reveal that through gracious attention, through bringing attention. When we get to the promise, the Abrahamic covenant phase, we understand God is going to give his presence in order to reveal his defense of relationship. He not only wants relationship, but he will defend relationship. He will defend the relationships that he wants to have with all people. And he does that. He demonstrates his faithfulness in relationship by establishing a covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants. So that's why he chooses a people. And that's also why he chooses a people who don't deserve it, right? He says in Deuteronomy to them over and over again, oh, by the way, you aren't a great people. You're not a people that was like, oh, I want a relationship with them. No, you're the least of people, and you're a stubborn people. And he will keep telling them over and over again, you don't deserve relationship, but I am going to establish a relationship with you so that my faithfulness in relationship is clearly seen, right? What if God had chosen the greatest nation on earth? The nation that just was just, you know, sparkly and yes, and large and strong,
no, stop.
Right?
You're not doing it right.
Girls.
It's hard to do it with somebody else. We all know how
to
do it
with long tails.
Somebody from the previous covenant should hold it.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's a really good idea,
wow.
Jen. You so hold it.
If he would have chosen like the Romans or whatever, it'd be like not by God's might, but by
exactly
their might.
Right?
Right.
So we wouldn't see God;
yeah,
we would
right.
see the people instead,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he chooses Israel, this people who were not a people, this people who, when he makes them a people, are just kind of a mess, as far as the world goes. And so he chooses this people, and he establishes a covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants. And we're going to go through some of the history of Israel, because we need to remember the history of Israel. That's good, girls.
Yeah. I'm going to give Jane a chance. I'm going to need help. I just had a shot in that knee yesterday.
Oh, geez.
And then this knee this morning.
Oh, wow.
When he establishes the covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants, he's also going to defend that special relationship. And he's going to defend it in a lot of ways. So we're going to go through some of those. And we're going to look at those and we're going to go, wow, that was a defense of his relationship with them. And then we'll begin to understand and see what's going on there. So he defends their special relationship, first of all, by redeeming them from death. So Abraham, he promises many descendants. That's redeeming from death in an A&E context, right? Because Abraham has no descendants, and it doesn't look like he'll ever have descendants. And that's death in an A&E society, right? To not have any descendants is death. And yet God says, I'm going to defend you. I'm going to bring you many, many descendants. And so God says, I'm going to be your defender. I'm going to defend relationship with you by redeeming you from death. He does that with Isaac, right? He saves Isaac from being sacrificed. And all of these go against the culture at the time. So remember, Abraham doesn't think too much about Isaac being sacrificed because that was normal in that society, that they would sacrifice a child. And God yet saves Isaac from being sacrificed, going against the culture.
Yeah, but that was a promised child.
Okay, and we'll talk about that in a second. Jacob. He saves Jacob from being ruled over somebody who doesn't care about his position, his privileged position. Esau, right? Because Esau was the firstborn. Esau should have had the rights of the firstborn. And yet God saves Jacob from being under such a man who doesn't care about his birthright. And if someone doesn't care about their birthright, the way they will rule will be very different, right? The way they will be the head of the family will be very different. And so God saves Jacob from that. God saves Jacob's family, once Jacob has a family, from famine, right? So he has a family, he's got 12 sons, and there's a famine in Egypt, or in Israel. And so God saves Jacob by bringing them to Egypt, right, eventually. God saves Israel, once they become Israel, of course, from slavery by taking them out of Egypt. Now, we just went through the history of Israel all the way up to the Exodus. Go back again and realizing not only does God defend his special relationship with Abraham and his descendants through redeeming them from death, he also names them as his own several different times, right? Abram, he changes his name to Abraham so that you will know that my promise to you to bring you out of death, to give you descendants, is true. I'm going to change your name because Abraham means prince of many. He no longer has the shame of having no descendants. Isaac, he gives the name he who laughs. And that's actually, I know we look at that and think that that's a derision, but it's not. It's this joyful laugh. It's this, Isaac is somebody who can be joyful in life and not discouraged. He takes Jacob and he renames Jacob. What does he rename Jacob?
Israel,
which means wrestling with God. Again, a good thing, not a bad thing. A good thing to be in conversation with God and figuring out the Psalms. When you read the imprecatory Psalms and the laments, that's wrestling with God, right? I'm free to be able to discuss with God everything that's going on. And then Israel, he names as his very own by bringing them, when they're in Egypt, by making sure they're all circumcised. And that keeps them separate. And it keeps them separate because anybody from Egyptian line, particularly Egyptian royal line, but any Egyptian line, no one is going to marry a mutilated people. So remember, circumcision was a practice in the A&E. But it was never the full circumcision, right? It was just a piece. It wasn't the entire foreskin taken off. And so when that was taken off, they were looked at as mutilated people. And that kept them separate from the Egyptians. That kept them making sure that they didn't intermarry in the Egyptians, because the Egyptian would never have married into that line. And so, again, he declares them as his own by giving them this special sign. And then we see him equipping them for a life of right relationship. Abraham, how does he equip him? He allows Abraham to know his plans beforehand, right? When he gives the covenant in Genesis 12, he also tells them, but here's the story. Here's what I'm going to do, Abraham. You're going to be the father of many people. You're going to have many descendants. But those descendants, they're going into slavery for 400 years. And I want you to know that because I also want you to know they're going to come out after 400 years. And after 400 years, they're going to come back to this land that I'm giving you now, this land will become theirs and they will be a great people. I'm telling this ahead of time. And when he tells Abraham that ahead of time, that sets the stage for Abram to be able to do the sacrifice of Isaac. Because Abraham knows, wait, God's giving me descendants through Isaac. I know that. He's already told me what's going to happen. He's been faithful because he's with me. And remember, he was with him to defend him because he was having many enemies at that time. I know that God is bringing descendants through Isaac. So he asked me to sacrifice him? Well, he must be doing something with that because he must be raising him from the dead, which is what Hebrews tells us that Abraham probably believed. But that was because God had already told him, I'm doing this. This is what I'm going to be doing. So I'm telling you, I'm going to give you what you need for right relationship in life. Isaac. What he does for Isaac is he makes him blind. And that's so that Isaac makes sure to bless the right son. Because if Isaac wasn't blind, he would have blessed Esau. When we see him equipping Jacob and Israel for life, we see him equipping Jacob by letting Joseph be lost, right? He gives Jacob a lost son, a son who he thinks is dead, right? His favorite son, Joseph. And how does that equip them for life? Right, because we know that Joseph becomes a person in charge of all the food so that down the line, not just Jacob, but Jacob's all sons are saved because they lost him in the beginning. I want you to begin to understand what God is doing here. He's doing things that in this present time, we think, how is that defending relationship? How is that giving me what I need for right life? And we so often ask that, right? What is God doing that this hard circumstance has come? But when we look at the line of Israel's relationship with God, we'll begin to see all of these and their purposes behind them. Is God is preparing them and equipping them for life down the road, right? For right relationship. He equips Israel. So when Jacob and his family go to Egypt to get food, they eventually stay there, right? Because Joseph is there and he's able to give them a land. And he's able to give them a land of their own in Egypt. So they get Goshen, right? So that's where the most northern part of Egypt, most northern eastern part. Goshen is all Israel's. And they get their own land. And what happens there is they get to learn how to farm. Because now they have their own land. Before that, they were nomads. They didn't know how to farm. But now they have a land of their own, and they learn how to farm. They learn how to produce crops. They learn how to produce and tend olive trees and the things that they'll need eventually in Israel. And because they have this land of Goshen, they continue to be separate from the Egyptians. But then God brings them into slavery. And of course, if you're in the middle of that, you're thinking, what is this going to do for us to prepare us for life? Well, how did slavery prepare them for life to come? It produced a lot more people. So the fastest way to grow a people is to oppress them. It's the fastest way physically to grow a people. So Israel's in slavery, they're oppressed, and they start producing lots and lots, right? Why do you think that is?
Nothing else to
bored.
Do.
Bored.
Right. Connection becomes even more important, right? The harder life is, the more connection becomes more important, right? And so we see that Israel begins to produce, and it's why the Egyptians became afraid. Israel is producing more and more. They're becoming a big people. They're going to be too powerful. We've got to push down them even harder. And you'll see that progression as you see Pharaoh pushing down even harder and harder on them, which only made them grow even more and more. We also know that in slavery, they learned trades that they would never have learned. They were farmers. First, they were nomads. Then they were farmers. And now, as slaves, what are they supposed to do as slaves?
Build.
Right? They learned to build. They learned to build all of the great buildings. And this is the place in the world at that time that has the most beautiful buildings. I mean, it's amazing. And this is where Israel gets to learn all the trades. They learn to be goldsmiths and silversmiths. They learn to be embroiderers and artists. They learn all of this because they're slaves. So that they are able to be able to have these abilities so that when they become their own people, they're able to produce that within the tabernacle and temple.
At this time, there were the men had many wives.
In Israel?
Yeah, during this time in the desert.
Yes, they did.
That's how they were able to produce so fast.
Yeah, that's a whole other line of... Because that was part of assimilating into the other cultures. But regardless, even if they only had one wife, because they're being oppressed, they will have more children. And that's sociologically, just go into any sociology book and you'll find that. The more oppression, the more children.
It's like that with Christianity, too. In these nations where people are being tortured and killed, they're just, it's blossoming.
Right, exactly. And where it's not being oppressed?
Here.
Yeah, right. Very few. We also see God showing his faithfulness to relationship by creating all of these distresses within their society, right? All these plagues that come about. And those stresses within their society, yes, mean they're not very happy with the Israelites, and they're not very happy with the Israelites, and they're not very happy with the Israelites, so that at the end, what happens?
They pay them to go.
Get out of here, take our stuff, and go. So that those distresses, again, in their society, that make them pariahs, actually bring to them all the wealth they will be able to use, not just for the tabernacle and temple, but they'll have all of these. Remember, the riches aren't just the material riches, but they're animals. They're calves and sheep and lambs and all those kind of things. So they'll have plenty for their sacrifices, etc. And then the very end, we actually see this small little, and you'll see this in all the stories if you want to pick it out. We see a grafted family as they're traveling out of Egypt. What we see is, remember, Moses is married into a pagan family, right? Mm-hmm. But when they're traveling, his father-in-law comes to them and says, I've seen what your God has done. And he worships God. Mm-hmm. So Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, actually sees God's attention to them, sees God's grace to them, and therefore sees this relationship and enters into that for himself. And of course, we don't know the story of Jethro, but we can imagine that he goes back to his family and that from seeing Israel's relationship with Yahweh, that Yahweh is going to be known in other parts too. There's lots of those little pieces if you look for them. So that in our ignorance, in Israel's ignorance and in our own ignorance, God uses covenant to display his grace to them, to give them what they did not deserve. So when I don't know what he's doing in my life, I can be sure that he's showing me grace and showing me what grace looks like. Oftentimes when we use the word grace, we think that it's something that's happy, right? Oh, he's giving me grace. Oh, I got a green light, grace, you know. Oh, I got just like, I was able to have this abundance. Oh, this is grace. But when we look at Israel's life, did it first of all look like grace?
No.
Not what we think of grace, right? First of all, it looked hard. And yet when we see the story, we understand, oh, that was actually God's grace. That was God's protection. That was God's giving them what they're going to need for life. And so we begin to understand what grace looks like when we look at Israel's story, when we look at the covenant story of God's relationship with his people, right? And when you look at your own relationship with your children, right? You're trying to give them grace. You're trying to give them what they need to grow, to actually be able to encompass life. But it's all of your just, oh, whatever you want, honey. Is that how you give them what they need?
No.
It isn't, right? Because they don't know. And there we see the same thing with God and his relationship with them. And that is so that Israel, so we can respond by trusting his faithfulness. Oh, what God is doing in my life, even though some of it seems very hard, I can trust that he's being faithful to me, that he's providing me with what I need for life, what I need for right relationship. I can trust his faithfulness all along. Not just the good things that he's given me, but the things that seem like they're not good. I can trust those, that they're good. So when we look at Israel, Paul tells us over and over again, Israel is our example. We need to look back and understand that God's dealings with Israel are always for their good. They're always to bring them to life. They're always to bring them to realize he's faithful. He's always giving them what they need. We need to be able to take that and bring that into our own lives. Oh, this hard thing, this hardship today, God is using this always to establish his covenant faithful with us. So I should be able to trust his faithfulness. When I intentionally look back on my life, I can put it into a covenant context, and I can see how he's been defending his relationship with me, my status with him. It's what, I don't remember which study we did, but we did life mapping. Remember that? Mm-hmm. That's the whole purpose of life mapping, is to be able to see where God has been faithful to bring you to a place where you are today and even beyond. As I look at the time, I'm not going to do this, but I went through my whole history of being born into a family that wasn't Christian, being sent to a Baptist church, literally dropped off at the curb. As little kids, as four-year-olds, we were dropped off at the curb and you went in. I was sent to a Christian Reformed high school, being a Baptist. So all of these things, I followed along and I thought, God was faithful. All of these times when it seemed like I was the outsider in each one of these places. When I went to the Christian Reformed High School, although I loved being there, we literally, the principal called us outsiders and would say, how do you outsiders like it here? And, you know, I'm glad I was so naive because it just didn't faze me too much. Now I would turn around and say, excuse me, let's sit down and talk. But all of that, going to a Presbyterian college that was Christian in name only, and there were hardly any Christians on campus. Going to, then, because of that, going to a Catholic college and graduating with a Bible minor from a Catholic college, recognizing that the body of Christ is here as well. And going from there to a Lutheran church when I was married and being the superintendent of Sunday school, and them accusing me of trying to make it a Baptist church because I was trying to instill memory verses, which was really funny. But again, what I took away from there, all of these beautiful things, God was preparing me for what I do. He was preparing me for my purpose and plan, my part in his plan. And I'm so thankful for all of those pieces. Because I never feel like there's only one way to look at how God has shown us. I've seen all these different ways. You need to be able to do that in your own life, to see how God has had his hand on faithfully bringing you along so that you can have a relationship with him. So we get to the Mosaic covenant phase, which is the picture. So we've had the plan, we've had the promise, and now we have a picture of what it's going to look like. And so God gives his words in order to reveal his person as holy. Remember that all the words of the Torah are all directed at right relationship, right? When we think of the 10 words, the 10 commandments, it's all about right relationship with God and right relationship with others. Those are his instructions, right? That's what he's giving. He's giving you his words to reveal himself as holy. And remember, holy is always this picture. Holy is perichoretic. Holy is giving fully of yourself and receiving fully of the other. God is holy. And so he gives his words about relationship with one another to reveal his holiness. And what he does in that covenant is he asks now for faithfulness from his people. He asks for faithfulness in relationship. I've shown you my faithfulness in a relationship. I've shown you that that's who I am. Would you be faithful in relationship to me? That's his ask of them. He wants them to do that. He gives them the instructions of how to live as valued wives, right? That's what those 10 words are. This is how you live when you understand you're valued as wife, as a valued wife, as a wife that has great worth. And of course they respond, we will do it. And he asks then for a demonstration through very specific holy behavior.
Your reluctant
raiders
are coming.
Your reluctant raiders are coming.
That's scary.
He wants them to demonstrate their faithfulness to him, which is why we have that whole ceremony on Mount Sinai. Moses reads the instructions and the people say, we'll do it. We'll live as valued wives. We will do this. And he asks then for continued faithful relationship in constructing the tabernacle. Live in my holiness. Live as if I'm with you all the time here. And the response is, what? How do they respond to being asked to live faithfully?
Not very well.
Not very well, right? Like within 40 days, they don't live faithfully. We have, in fact, Aaron leading that, right? We have Aaron leading the idolatry to the golden calf. And so Aaron, who gets chosen as the priest, as the high priest, he can't offer his own clean life, right? He's got to be chosen and cleansed for himself. He has to be, and if you were with us for Leviticus, what in order for Aaron to become the high priest, what has to happen to him?
To go through the rituals.
Yeah, what's the first ritual that he goes through?
He
gets naked in front of everyone. He gets stripped naked. He gets washed. And then he gets reclothed, right, with white clothes and with a crown that says, holy to the Lord. I mean, right there, that picture there is, we all know what Aaron did. Aaron's not holy. God has put on him his holiness, his relationship with him. So that God asks these asking of faithful giving of this asking for a faithful relationship, what God is doing with the old covenant, with the Sinai covenant, is he's giving them opportunities to fail within a conditional covenant, but it's in the context of the bigger covenant of the Abrahamic covenant. So he's not saying, I want to see if you fail, and just leaving you off there. Remember, it's always within the context of a very unconditional covenant, that Abrahamic covenant. And he's giving them opportunities to fail. Do you give your kids opportunities to fail?
Of course. Yeah.
Why?
Learn how they learn.
What do they learn?
To grow up. Well, they learn failure, and then they correct. Make a quartz correction.
Mm-hmm. God is trying to teach them. They can't do it on their own, right? That's what he's teaching Aaron. You can't be a priest on your own. You can't have right relationship with me on your own. You can't make right relationship. You can't establish right relationship. And you can't maintain right relationship on your own. But they'll never know that if he doesn't give them the opportunity to fail. That's what the old covenant is about. I'm giving you this opportunity to see that you can't do it on your own. All the things they needed for the tabernacle, right? When he says build the tabernacle, could they have built the tabernacle on their own? Mm-hmm. I want you to think how did God prepare them for life? He gave them all the materials, right? Did they get those materials? Did they work for those materials?
No.
How about the skills that they had to put those materials together? Did they say, you know, I want to be apprentice and be a silversmith? No, they were put into slavery. God gave them those skills. We have a priest. Was this priest like, was he the best one out of all of them?
Probably not.
No, obviously not, because he led them into idolatry. God says, look, you can't do any of this on your own. You can't build my dwelling place here by yourself. You can't be holy on your own. I have to make you holy. I have to give that to you. You need to learn that relationship is about dependence and interdependence rather than independence, right? You don't learn to be a wife by going off and reading lots of books and taking a test, right? Did any of you learn to be a wife that way?
No.
I remember literally the night before my wedding, I sat down with my grandmother, whom I lived with, and I said, with a notebook, and I said, okay, teach me how to cook. Just tell me how to do it all. Maybe that's why I don't like to cook. And I literally sat down and wrote recipes. Like, this is going to teach me how to be a good wife and cook. It doesn't work that way, right? You actually have to experience the relationship. You have to actually be in that relationship. I can't be a good wife apart from being connected and dependent to a husband, right? You can't. You just can't do it. So that in our failure, God teaches us our need for the grace of covenant relationship. The Abrahamic or the Mosaic covenant made sure that we understood our proclivity to independence. And its breaking meant a loss of benefits, but not a loss of relationship. And that's very key to us understanding that. They lost the benefits of relationship, but they didn't lose relationship because they were in an Abrahamic covenant where God had already promised relationship that he wasn't going to break it. So again, God brings them to this place of helping them fail, but actually in a place that's very safe, right? Which is exactly how we do it with our children. We let them fail, but we're always there, right? We're going to make sure that the failure isn't a failure of relationship. It's a failure of loss. You're going to lose the benefits of some of the relationship. So what we learn to do then is not, we've learned to trust his faithfulness by the Abrahamic covenant. In the Mosaic covenant, we learn to not trust our own faithfulness. And this is something I think so many of us have failed to do, is not trust our own faithfulness. When Bill and I were being counseled for a marriage, okay, we were really young, completely naive. And I remember the pastor saying to both of us individually and together, why do you think this marriage is going to work? And we both said, because we are determined that it will. And we were completely sincere, because we are determined. We are going to make this work. Mm-hmm. Years later, I heard from a friend of mine who was good friends with the pastor. The pastor had told her, I don't think that marriage is going to last.
Oh, gosh.
Mm-hmm. And if we would have continued with that idea, because we are determined, it would have failed, right? We had to learn, our determination just isn't enough. It is only through God's grace, right, that it is able. So I can't trust my own determination. I can't trust my own faithfulness in relationship with God. My faithfulness in relationship with God is nothing. It's just as Israel. Within 40 days, it's completely destroyed. I can't trust my own faithfulness. So when the failure of the Mosaic covenant, when the Israelites' failure to keep their covenant, what happens is the community disintegrates. And it disintegrates so badly that they come to a point where they begin to fight one another and kill off one another. Right? That's the whole book of Judges. Judges shows us what happens when people begin to rely on their own faithfulness in a relationship. It falls apart. And we see the whole community falling apart in relationships. So that the relationships, when you read the book of Judges, all you see are messed up relationships. And the more you delve into Judges, the more messed up you realize it is. Not just their relationship with one another, but the relationship with God, which is what causes the disintegration in relationship with one another. And we see that so that it culminates. Judges goes into First Samuel, which would be the historically next step, And we see in 1 Samuel that they actually lose God's presence. Does anybody know how they lose God's presence in 1 Samuel? They fight the Philistines, and something gets captured. The Ark of the Covenant gets captured, and the Ark of the Covenant is no longer in their presence. It belongs to the Philistines for a while. And so we see that their relationship with God has become, they've used the Ark of the Covenant as a lucky charm. Let's bring the Ark and Covenant to any battles we go to. Now, we don't have a relationship with God. We're not asking God what to do. But let's bring this in. We want to do this. Let's bring this in. It's like praying, okay, God, we want to go destroy these people. Come on, God, come with us. Or the idea of, I hate this phrase where people say it's better to ask forgiveness.
Than ask for permission.
Yeah. Same kind of idea. That's what they do with the Ark of the Covenant. And so they lose the Ark of the Covenant. All of that is a picture of what happens when they try to depend on their own faithfulness in relationship to God. They lose their relationship with God and with one another. They are a destroyed people. But all of that brings them to a place that they finally say, you know what? We need someone to lead us because we're doing a horrible job. We need a king. And of course, their first attempt, they're still trying to be independent. They recognize what they need, but they want to choose that king. And so they choose Saul. And of course, that fails. But it is not until that failure that they recognize, all right, we do need someone to lead us, and it's got to be God. And God's got to choose the king. And so all of that failure led to them opening up for God to choose David as their king. So we see that they begin, space gets made because of their failure, because they come to a point where they say, wow, we can't do this on our own. We can't continue relationship with God on our own. God's going to have to help us and give us a leader who can lead us to that place. And so we come to the Davidic covenant, and we call that, so David is usually called the administrator of the covenant. But I needed a P word, so I'm using proprietor. When you think about proprietor, he's one who, right, puts everything into order so that people can actually use that. So whether it's a proprietor, I asked Bill, when you think of proprietor, what do you think? And he said, somebody who owns an inn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was interesting. I said, I always think of somebody who owns a store. But it's someone who's going to put things in order and actually for other people, right? It's actually so that other people can have what they need. And so we have the Davidic covenant establishing order in order to reveal God's position as king. So God appoints then a faithful proprietor to model faithfulness in relationship. The first thing David does is to return the ark. That's the first thing he does within the period that we consider the Davidic covenant. And so we see him bringing back God's presence into their community. And then, of course, we see David ordering worship, right? Liturgical worship, where there's an actual order of how to converse with God. We have the Psalms, we have the priest's jobs, and we have ways of speaking with God. Up until this time, people aren't speaking to God in all those different ways, right? They're not speaking to God. And what we have with the Psalms is, it's not just praise. When we think about worship, we always think of just praise, right? But all of those who are in Psalms, we know. All of these are praise. We have praise, we have thanksgiving, we have laments, we have imprecations, and we have exaltations, which are the Royal and Torah Psalms. We have all of those are conversations with God that are ways of speaking with God. So that David shows his faithfulness to God by bringing in this order of worship and by bringing God's presence back into the community of Israel. But he also establishes God's order through protecting and expanding the kingdom, right? Under David, we have the kingdom expanded to the largest it can be. And we have that because David is actually warring against any cultures that want to introduce a transactional relationship. Because remember, this is sacred space where right relationship is seen and is modeled. And so that's what David does. So that what we see is that in our disorder, God leads us to the grace of covenant order, which is righteousness and justice. It's grace that he shows us that that's the order that we need. What happens, of course, with the Davidic covenant and the Davidic descendants is we have, again, disorder resulting from the unfaithfulness of all the Davidic kings. That's 1 and 2 Kings. That's what 1 and 2 Kings is all about, is all of the ways that they were unfaithful to justice and righteousness. And that leads to a loss, many losses. First loss, and this kind of gets into where you did the Ezekiel and Jeremiah passages. The first loss is God's immediate presence. Did you read the Ezekiel passage where God's presence, the cloud leaves the temple? Did you read that? Yes. So it leaves the temple, and where does it stand?
In front of the people?
Mm-mm.
On the Mount of Olives. It stands on the Mount of Olives. And that's the last time we see his presence until the presence comes back from the Mount of Olives and goes back into the temple, right? In Jesus, right? Yeah. So remember, all the details of God's story actually fill in as we come into the new covenant. And so we see the loss of God's immediate presence, his Shekinah glory moves to the Mount of Olives, but then we actually see his dwelling place, his temple destroyed. He has no place to come back to from the Mount of Olives until Jesus is ready to take that place again. We have the loss of land because at this point, now they're going to be exiled into Babylon. So they lose that sacred space. And biggest of all for Israel is they lose their identity as a nation because they have no king. Once a nation has no king, they aren't a nation. So they lose their identity. They lose their identity as a nation because of the loss of a king. So this happens, of course, the line of unfaithful kings in the Davidic line. But that exile, again, will prepare them for the next phase of the covenant. So on the brink of the judgment, when the Shekinah glory leaves, both Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah, but we looked at Ezekiel and Jeremiah, they began to prophesy and say, yes, this judgment is going to happen. There will be judgment. Why? What did Ezekiel say? Tell us, why is there judgment? I don't think she had you read enough of Ezekiel. You should have read lots of it. Why is there judgment? What have the people done? They had broken covenant, but what was the big thing?
More idol worship. Were they intermarrying?
I don't think she had you read that. It was profaning his name. It was not being a representative of who he was, as gracious, attentive, holy, with them, king. They were not showing the nations that that was who God was. They profaned his name. So remember, profane, that word profane actually means to live outside the tabernacle. So that they were living as if God was not in their midst. That they were living as if God was not affecting who they were. They were living as if they weren't living in sacred space and showing the nation sacred space. And so they had to be judged for that. Why? Because they were showing the nations a lie about who God was. They were named as God's people, and they weren't living as if God was holy and king and with them. So their judgment was a sign to the nations that God would not stand for injustice in his own people. God had to tell the nations, my people cannot defame me by telling a lie about me. I will make sure that that doesn't happen. I will take them out of the land. That Ezekiel 11 tells us that that's exactly why what the nations saw is that God judging his own people says that God will not let injustice happen within his own people. And in the New Testament, we have it again. God will first cleanse the church, because the church is what represents who God is. Secondly, the other purpose of judging them was to do, and it says in Jeremiah, to do the people good, to do his own people good. Judgment was for their good. Just like the judgment in Eden of keeping them away from the tree of life was good, so this is good, because it would return the fear of the Lord to their hearts, so they wouldn't turn away. Remember we talked about fear, I don't remember what, maybe a semester ago, two semesters ago. Fear is recognizing who has more power, who has power over you. And they weren't recognizing that God has the power of life. This would remind them, oh, right, we need to fear God because he is the one who has the power. Thus, what the judgment is doing is restoring reality to his people. You have to know that it is God who has the power. But Ezekiel and Jeremiah tell him, God is going to judge you, but that's not the end of the story. God is also going to restore you. He has not forsaken his covenant relationship. He's actually cleansing that relationship. He's making sure that relationship remains right. And he's going to establish a new covenant phase, one which will fulfill all the phases previous and will come finally to its climax and to restore God's original design. And this is where you did a lot of your homework, by restoring that heart of stone, by taking out their heart of stone. And when it talks about heart, it's always that place of the will, taking out that independent will and giving them a flesh that is full of Zoe. So the word Zoe is the Greek word for life. And he's going to give them this heart of Zoe. And Zoe, when it talks about life, it's always talking about God's life, that kind of life. We'll talk about life in just a second. He'll put his spirit in them. He'll return them to the sacred space, to the land. And that's important because that gives them purpose again. Now that they're ready for purpose, now that they've been restored with true life. And these are the parts of Ezekiel. If you have time, read on through Ezekiel, because it gets more and more exciting. And I wish she would continue, that she would have us read more and more. Because not only is he going to take away their heart of stone, give them a heart of flesh, put his spirit in them, but it says he will restore all the fields and the fruit trees with abundance so that they are like, again, the Garden of Eden. And of course, when you see that, you recognize, oh, this is new creation. This is recreation again, which is always going back toward. It then says, and it'll increase their people like a flock. And that they'll have more people than they know what to do with within their family. And then we get to Ezekiel 37. Does anybody know what Ezekiel 37 is? I want to do the dance. If anyone went to our Saturday service. Dry bones. It is, I am going, you were dead, and now I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to resurrect you. And he's got a whole chapter on the resurrection of his people. Bones that are dead and have no breath. And they now will have the breath of God back in them. And then even after that, he talks about restoring two kingdoms into one kingdom again, who will be under one king. This is Ezekiel 37 and 38. One king, a Davidic servant, who will be a shepherd to them. So as they are leaving for Babylon, this is what Jeremiah and Ezekiel are telling the people. You're being judged because you have not represented God well. But he's bringing you back, and this is what he's going to do. He's going to start restoration again. He's going to recreate Eden, but then have Eden do what it was supposed to do. Remember, Adam and Eve were supposed to increase Eden so that it grew all over the earth, and that's what God is going to do through you, but for you as well. And he's going to restore you, and he's going to restore you under a Davidic servant shepherd. And he uses all of these words. And so, when they are in Babylon, they know that when they come back, at some point, God is going to resurrect this Davidic servant shepherd as a king. They're looking for that. So, what God wants us to see is that we can respond by following his faithful lead into death. this exile was good for them. It was good for them to be able to be cleansed, to give up their own will, their own, that stone heart is always, when it talks about, I always want to jump ahead. It's suke. We talked about suke a long time ago. Anybody remember this? Suke is that is the heart of my will, my independence, my desires. The Davidic king was supposed to represent God's will and desire, not his own, right? So David was always supposed to represent what God wanted. And God wanted, he wants relationship. He wants to name worth in people. He wants to defend and tend relationship with people. He wants to make space for people. So it wasn't the human king's plans that were to be made. It was God's plans. It wasn't, the victory wasn't the human king's victory. It was God's victory. That the king was supposed to be able to say, it's not about me, it's about God. So that his leadership as king was always a leadership into death, about ourselves, and God's life, looking to God for it. So that when we allow ourselves to be led into death, we acknowledge, just like David did, that the defense of our status is God's victory, not our own. That God is doing the battle. God is fighting the battle for us. God is directing us into the battle. So that when I say that Bill and I decided that we could make this marriage work, and to find out really quickly, we can't make this marriage work. And we got, if we don't depend on God, it's going to fail. And to be able to see these many years later, 38 years later, only through God's grace does that continue to happen. So that exile is always about death of self, death of independence, death of that heart of stone. In effect, a cleansing of profane separation. There was an exile that began each phase of the covenant. And each exile was followed by a transitional time of learning, of being cleansed and learning what it was to have right relationship, to receive right relationship. So when we look at the Adamic exile, we see them exiled out of the garden, right? So that they would have a time of understanding their ways, their deciding what was good and evil, didn't work. Noahic exile, right? Everyone was taken out of the earth. So that Noah and his family would begin to understand we can't live separate from God. The Abrahamic exile, Abraham was taken out of Ur. Remember, he was a pagan. He understood only transactional religion, not relationship. He was taken out of that, out of his family, so that he could begin to learn what was true, what is reality. Of course, Mosaic exile, we have them coming out of Egypt. And of course, they come out of Egypt into the wilderness. And the wilderness is the place where they begin to learn about what it is to have relationship with a God who keeps on paying attention to them. The Davidic exile was when the ark left. They no longer had God's presence, so that God actually exiled himself so that they were left without his presence. And then we have the new covenant exile, which began with the exodus of Israel out of the land with no temple, no land, no nation, no king. And then the transitional period is a long... So when we see the space, it looks longer. It's just that we tell more detail of that. This transitional period from the time they were exiled to now is this bringing in of the new covenant, being able to be willing to accept this new paradigm of the covenant. So that exile is not just always about death, but it is always intended to bring us to a place of readiness to enter into life, recognizing and paying attention to what life really is.
Sorry, Jill, I didn't quite get that. Like the exile, David's exile, the protective presence, I get that. New covenant exile. Like what's the exile?
So when
he went off.
No. So it started, remember, it always starts the... When did the new covenant first be proclaimed.
Was it Jeremiah?
Jeremiah and Ezekiel. And they proclaimed it on the eve of them leaving to Babylon. Okay. Right? So that's when that's why the exile of the new covenant is starts there. So we have it there, we have the all of what it's going to look like there, and then it keeps going. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So when we talk about it makes us ready to understand what real life is. Real life isn't what the Greek says is bios. It's not physical life. Right? That's not the reality. It's not simply physical life, whatever satisfies my physical needs, my hunger and my thirst. In other words, when I lose my health, all of a sudden I realize that life wasn't really about eating whatever I want. As I get older and things happen, Bill and I always talk about, oh, if we would only known, would we have eaten better? Would we have exercised better? Would we have taken care of our body? But I remember, really, really young when we got married, I remember us getting married. First we were saying, this is going to be so great. We are going to be able to eat coffee, ice cream, and with Reese's Pieces and hot fudge. We can eat it for breakfast if we want. And sometimes we did. We felt like that was life, right? We could eat whatever we want. And literally, we would eat it for weeks on end. And I still think, oh, that was good. I can't eat that now. But now I go, was that life? No, that wasn't life. So it's when you lose something, you realize, oh, it wasn't eating coffee, ice cream, and hot fudge, and Reese's Pieces spread all over it. That wasn't life.
I remember thinking when I was that age, I could eat all the cookie dough I want.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. And now you realize, oh, right. That actually wasn't life. To be able to...
I think it was more about the freedom.
Right, and that's the thing. We think the freedom is being able to satisfy ourselves. And that's what God is teaching us over and over again, which with each exile for Israel, he's teaching them, it isn't about what you want. That's not going to make you fully human. What's going to make you fully human is right relationship with me. And I'm going to teach you that little by little over the course of all of your history. But it's also not suke, right? Which is not just the physical desires, but the willful desires, our emotional desires, right? I really like this. I like being able to do whatever. But it's not until we lose a loved one where we recognize, oh, success actually wasn't life. It wasn't about getting things done. Like, I love to get things done. I love to be productive. But then when I look over life and I, you know, if I lose a loved one and I think, wow, all the time I spent getting things done, I could have been spending in relationship, right? But you don't recognize that until you lose that, right? And so as you get older, you begin to recognize these things more and more. So that it's not bios, it's not suke. Real life is zoe. And zoe is that fullness of the perichoretic life of God. It is that abundant life of completely giving yourself out and completely receiving the other. And here's an interesting thing I found out about Zoe. I never knew this before. The Greek word Zoe is actually the adaptation of the Hebrew word Hava. But we pronounce Hava Eve. So Zoe is actually the Greek of Eve, the Hebrew Eve. That is the life God has always intended for us, to be his wife, to be this part of his life, that we actually live in his life. Made me realize that if I have another daughter, I would name her Hava. Do you know anybody named Hava?
No.
What about Fiddler on the Roof?
I know, that's what I thought.
Yep. One of the daughters is named Hava. I never knew that was how they pronounced Eve. So judgment then makes us attentive to look for, it made Israel attentive to look for the promise of the Abrahamic covenant, which was God's presence. And it made them attentive to look for God's presence that would be dwelling in a tent of God's word, as pictured in the Mosaic covenant. And that dwelling in a tent of God's word would look like a king, a Davidic proprietor who reorders life with righteousness and justice. And that king would be one who would give back the life of Eden while increasing it with countless family, so that it's not just a restoration of Eden, but a restoration of Eden expanded into a larger family. And so, of course, we know that the new covenant not only fulfills all of that, it doesn't just take us back to Eden, it takes us back to Eden's intention of growing bigger and wider. And so we understand that the new covenant circles all the way around back to the Adamic covenant and fulfills that and then continues to grow that. And, of course, that increasing in the countless family is where we get the idea of all the Gentiles being grafted in, which I think you did enough homework for that. And we finally get to the provision, the new covenant phase, so that God gives his own life in order to reveal himself as the source of life. He offers his own faithfulness in relationship by the sending of his son, vulnerably giving all of himself, and then by the son's recapitulation of both Adam and Israel. When he gives himself as the son, we see Jesus named Emmanuel, God with us. And what you're going to begin to see is each time we see the phase in Jesus' life, we see him fulfilling what God has told us all along on that path. Is God is gracious, God is attentive, God is with us, Emmanuel. When we see the son's recapitulation of both Adam and Israel, do you know what I mean by that? When I say the recapitulation of Adam and... Okay, so that what we see in Jesus' life in the new covenant is him redoing Adam's life how it should have been, redoing Israel's life how it should have been, shows what faithfulness to God's covenant would look like. That's what he does. So that when we see Jesus in the wilderness temptations, that's a recapitulation of both Adam and Israel. Because when we get to Genesis 3 for Adam, he's in a wilderness, right? Because nobody's around. It seems like he's all alone. It seems like God isn't there. We've talked about Genesis 3. Like Adam and Eve are left on their own. Where's God? It seems like a wilderness. And then they get tempted, right? And they get tempted to try to decide on their own. And for Israel, they have wilderness temptations, right? They go into the wilderness after having come out of Egypt. They go into the wilderness. So that when you follow Jesus' life, you will begin to see him redoing Adam's life and Israel's life. And everything he does is meant to do it again the right way. That's what we begin to see in Jesus' life. So the wilderness temptations led to the wilderness. And Jesus is led to the wilderness just after coming out of the waters with a sweet affirmation of belonging. Same thing with Adam. I should have brought it. I have a painting from Ron DeCiani where it's called Adam, but it's coming out of the waters and the dove coming, and it's Jesus' baptism. So we have Jesus coming out of the water of creation, being named as my son, which has happened to Adam, right? The waters of creation. God names Adam, God names humanity as his very own image bearers. What about Israel? Do they ever come out of the water and be named his son? They go through the Red Sea. You are my people. Always, 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 Jesus is recapitulating those two stories. Then, of course, Jesus gets tempted. Tempted to think, oh, there's a better plan than God had. God has this plan, but there's a better plan. For Adam and Eve, it was, you know, eating the apple that they could choose. For Israel, it's going back to eat the food of Egypt, right? And Jesus says,
what did God say?
What does God say? He's going to listen. Man does not live by bread alone, but by
every word.
Is spoken by my Father, by the word of God. So that Jesus, unlike Adam, unlike Israel, keeps his attention on the words of his Father. The words of his Father that he just heard are, you are beloved, you belong, you have purpose. He keeps that, demonstrating that he's a listening son. And so we have this go back and read all the gospel stories and you'll begin to understand what Jesus is doing with his life. So we see him as a listening son in the temptations. From there, he begins his ministry, right? That launches his ministry, where he begins to start to establish relationships with people who no one else is having relationships with, right? We see him establishing relationships with women, with lepers, with tax collectors, with prostitutes, with Syrians, with all sorts of Gentiles, right? By the way, the feeding of the 4,000, you know, there's two stories. One's 5,000, one's 4,000. The feeding of the 4,000 is all Gentiles. 5,000 is the Israelites and the 4,000 the Gentiles. So we see Jesus beginning to establish relationship with all the people who don't have relationship. We see this beginning establishment of justice, right? Of righteousness. We see Jesus always talking to the Father. In John, he says over and over again, I never say anything that I haven't heard my Father say. I only say what the Father says. I'm listening all the time and saying what he is saying. So that we get to this point, and what has, since the exile to Babylon, they came back to the land, but they never got a king. They are still in some respect exiled. They are still not a nation because they have no king. So Israel, back in the land, what are they looking for?
A king.
A king who will be Davidic, who will be a servant. Isaiah, we didn't look at, but he'll be suffering. And he will be a shepherd. That's what they're looking for. And a king, remember, is someone who feeds, who makes sure that they're supplied with everything they need, and someone who makes sure relationships are equal. So we see that. We see Jesus doing that, and the people see that, which is, of course, what we talked about in the feeding of the 5,000. We saw them want him to make him king. And he says, no, I will not let you make me king now, because the throne of justice and righteousness is not yet ready. And so that is his ministry, until the point where he actually does take up the crown. His declaration in the Last Supper is that he is the new covenant. And he will start to begin to ascend the throne by first on Palm Sunday. And Lord Jean, you talked about kids saying, why is Palm Sunday such a big deal? And then the crucifixion doesn't seem to be a big deal. But this Palm Sunday is when Jesus finally acquiesces, I will be the king, right? So that he gets on a donkey. He allows them to praise him with hosannas and with palm branches. All three are messianic kingship symbols. Everybody knows that. He knows that. All the people know that. And he allows that to happen. Where does he start the procession from the Palm Sunday?
Mount of Olives.
That's where he starts. The presence of God has returned to Jerusalem, and it goes down. And where does he go? Into the temple. And he cleanses the temple. This is a house of prayer. This is a house for all people to come in conversation with God. And then he is lifted to the throne. And within that week, he is lifted to the throne. And that throne is, where does he put on a crown?
On the cross.
King of the Jews. That's the throne. All the way back to Noah, he said, I am not going to be your king by force. I'm not going to have a relationship by force. I'm going to have a relationship with you by sacrifice, by giving myself completely to you. I'm not just going to give you a little piece of me. This is what he's been demonstrating all the time through all the covenants. I'm going to continue to give myself over and over to you in the midst of your rebellion, in the midst of your ignorance, in the midst of your need. I'm going to give you myself over and over again. So that he actually is lifted up onto the throne that embodies a just and righteous king. Because remember, the king will take responsibility and be accountable for the unrighteous and injustices of his people. That's what happens on the cross. That's what happens when we talk about Christ dying for our unrighteousness, for our injustices. And he recapitulates then man's needed cry. All the way back in Genesis 1, When Adam has sinned, when he has separated himself from God, what does God want him to do?
Cry out.
Look for me. And he doesn't. So God, in Genesis 3, already says, I will cry out for you. Where are you? Which is what Jesus does on the cross. God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? But remember, everyone listening, when you say the first line of a song you know well, everyone knows the rest of it, right? Everyone knows this is Psalm 22. Everyone knows. We reading it go, that sounds weird. Why does he say God's forsaken me? What's the end of Psalm 22? And if we had time, I would have us read it. Read Psalm 22. Because the end of Psalm 22 is talks about, God, you are holy. You have been with me. You are my strength. When I cry out, you hear me. Kingship belongs to you. He says to God everything that we've talked about here, right there in Psalm 22. That's what Jesus is proclaiming. He says the first verse of the song that everybody knows, and everybody knows where it ends. And it ends in that, I will proclaim your glory. I will make sure to proclaim your righteousness to a people yet unborn, that he has done it. He has shown his faithfulness in the completion of his covenant, of his one covenant relationship. He's shown that he's faithful and worthy of relationship. It is finished. So that Jesus actually says the first verse and the last verse of Psalm 22 to say, this is what this has been all about. The covenant has been completed. I have revealed God completely as holy, as king, as the source of life. And now the sacred space, the garden temple, is open for anyone to come and receive that life. Now that you've seen my faithfulness, now do you want me as your florist? I've shown you what a good florist I am, right? Do you want me as your musician? I've shown you. I've played every concerto you can ever think of. Now, do you want that? That's the whole line of covenant, showing he is trustworthy to be faithful in relationship, to bring you into his own life. And so that we have the resurrection and the ascension, which we don't often talk about, but so important, because it is at the ascension where we finally see a human being as part of the Trinity. A human being is now sitting within God's life, in the Trinity. Until then, humanity was always part of the counsel of God. His people were part of the counsel of God, but now humanity is actually part of his life. Human being sitting in that perichoretic Trinity. And as his body grows on earth, it will be the fulfillment of the increase that Ezekiel talks about to Israel. So that in our need, God comes to us with the grace of his covenant faithfulness. So I respond not by trusting my own faithfulness, by trusting his faithfulness to be my faithfulness. It's like the idea that, how many of you played on the National Cubs team that won the pennant? How many of you said, we won! We won! Right? You take that as if you did the accomplishment. That's what God is saying. Take my faithfulness. I accomplished it. It's yours. It's yours. Not your faithfulness, but in your need, I accomplished it. I won. And that's your victory as well. So that, there's no way. I thought this was going to be a short lesson. Ultimately, maybe I'll start with this next week. I want you to see that everything the covenant has shown is actually just Genesis 1 and 2. It is in the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. He made a space, a sacred space, devoted to a place that we could have secure attachment. That's the plan, the promise, and the Spirit hovered. His presence was available there. The picture in the mosaic, and God said 10 times, and God said, and God said, and God said. God gave his word. And in the Davidic, the first day, the second day, there's order. There's order in the proprietary Davidic covenant. And the provision, God rested in Sabbath so that his life is now recognized in us. His life is actually able to rule and relate within you. And he has no obstacle. That is the whole idea of the covenant, is showing Genesis 1 and 2 recapitulated and growing. So here's a really quick summary. He wants right relationship with us. That's his desire. He's shown us his faithfulness in relationship. That's Abrahamic. The Mosaic, we can't make right relationship happen on our own efforts, with our own efforts. That's Mosaic. He's able to lead us into death for the purpose of real life, Zoe life. That is the Davidic. And the New Covenant, he gives us his life to take as our own life, his faithfulness to relationship, for our own faithfulness to relationship. So that we jeopardize God's self-revelation when we don't pay attention to his faithfulness. We jeopardize God's self-revelation when we don't trust his faithfulness. When we say that these bad things that are happening, God is not paying attention to me. God is not doing this for my good. When we jeopardize God's self-revelation when we trust our own faithfulness. I can do this. I can try to match God's faithfulness. I jeopardize God's self-revelation when I refuse to be led to the death of my own self-will. And I jeopardize God's self-revelation when I don't receive his faithfulness as my faithfulness. That's the whole story of the covenant relationship. What can we possibly have more to talk about? Plenty. Father, thank you for telling us your story, but not just telling us that you're a faithful God, showing us that you are a faithful God to stubborn people. You're a faithful God to ignorant people, to people who fail over and over and over again, to people who are so needy. Lord, you've shown us your faithfulness to Israel, and you've shown us over and over again in our own lives your faithfulness to us. We grab your faithfulness as our own. We thank you for giving it openly, vulnerably, and we pray, Lord, that this week we might walk in your faithfulness and be so Easter people that people are compelled to know and hear the story of your faithfulness. In Jesus' name, amen.